Today's WBFO brief was recorded at around 8:30 in the morning. This is WBFO News.
Byron Brown's decision to become president and CEO at Western Regional Off-Track Betting appears to be paying off for the former mayor and two former members of his administration. The Buffalo News reports Brown's new salary will be $295,000 a year, a substantial upgrade from his compensation as Buffalo's mayor. Additionally, Steve Casey, who served in the Brown administration through 2014, is now Brown's chief of staff and chief administrative officer at an annual salary of $190,000. Mike DeGeorge is also leaving his job as City Hall spokesperson to earn $130,000 a year as director of communication at Western Regional Off-Track Betting. The move follows the controversial $299,000 buyout provided to Henry Roy Tazek upon his departure as CEO at OTB. A neighborhood block party Saturday will serve as a voter registration drive on Buffalo's east side. The effort, called Souls to the Polls, will take place from 11 until 5 at the Delavan Grider Community Center, where eligible residents can register to vote and then cast their vote on the first day of early voting at the same location. The event is being hosted by Voice Buffalo and the Healthcare Education Project. And $1 million in state funding will allow for upgrades at Beaver Island State Park on Grand Island. According to State Senator Sean Ryan, the funds will provide ADA beach access, an accessible playground, and a new dog park. At a cost of $170,000, a new 60-foot ADA-compliant boardwalk ramp will allow visitors with disabilities access to the water. The Rosa Copeland Living Center in Amherst will be closing. That development was confirmed Thursday by the State Department of Health following weeks of controversy over the failure to pay wages and cover benefits for employees. The facility, located on the Weinberg campus on North Forest Road, is home to 120 residents. It will, owners say the doors will be closed by the end of November or earlier if all residents have been moved out. Two historic structures in the Cobblestone District that were ravaged by fire earlier this year will not be demolished. That was the unanimous ruling Thursday from the Buffalo Preservation Board after reviewing the request for demolition by the building's owner, Daryl Carr. The Buffalo News reports the board's vote followed a 15-minute public hearing that heard Buffalo Common Council member Mitch Nowakowski criticize Carr's stewardship of the structures on South Park Avenue that date back to the 19th century. Carr has been seeking to demolish the structures to clear for the development of a proposed 55-story building in the Cobblestone District. And the subject of student suspensions, Buffalo schools, will be at the center of a morning press conference. A coalition of groups, including Buffalo Public School parents and students, will be at the event to highlight the National Week of Action Against School Pushout. Organizers say they'll release a report that shows the quote-unquote widespread discrimination in the suspension process utilized by the Buffalo Public School District. Speaking of the Kensington Expressway, that is going to be front and center later today when a judge hears arguments over the possible injunction stopping construction or possibly stopping construction on the Kensington makeover, the controversial Kensington makeover. And with us to talk more about that right now is the lead counsel for over 60 plaintiffs in this case, and that's Alan Bozier joining us by phone this morning. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. And our time is brief, and I know you have a lot to do today. So first of all, what's at the core of the argument here that says this project has to be stopped?
All right. My clients have already received a temporary restraining order, which says that construction cannot proceed. That's really a quick measure, and now the judge has set it down for a preliminary injunction this afternoon. He's going to hear us, as well as the state, argue over whether there should be an injunction to stop construction from going forward. What's it about? It's about the 4.5 years of construction that the department wants to do, Department of Transportation. What they want to do is they want to construct a tunnel over a small portion of the Kensington Expressway, leaving the rest. It's a lawsuit about the taking of Humble Parkway 60 years ago. It's a lawsuit about the health of this community, which has horrible rates of illness in it, top 98, 99 percentile of respiratory illnesses, cardiovascular illnesses, the lowest life expectancies in New York State. DOT wants to continue this expressway for another 75 or 100 years. Now is the chance for the community to they we have 60 plaintiffs. We could have many more, but now is the time for doing something different, looking at this differently, and what's more, stopping this 4.5 years of construction that they want to do.
Interesting that you mentioned the community, because I'm just going to read a quote here from a story about this, quoting Acting Mayor Chris Scanlon, who says, "I think we have to be careful at times that thinking that we hear from residents, meaning many residents, that they may be speaking for the majority of residents in this case." So he says, "At this point, I'm okay with us moving forward on this project." I guess what he's trying to say is, are these just a few people that are talking about this, or does this really, this urge to stop this project, is this widespread inside the East Side community?
Not just the East Side community, where it is widespread. We could easily have many more plaintiffs. But if you drive around Buffalo, you're going to see the Restore Humboldt Parkway signs everywhere. You're going to see Stop the Toxic Tunnel everywhere. What you will not see is build the superhighway. Keep that superhighway in the middle of our city so nobody has to stop on the way from outside the city into the downtown core. Yes, there's plenty of community support for this.
Who is not listening? Who is not listening in this case, as best you understand? I know you're the attorney. You're not necessarily a community organizer, but who's not listening in this case?
I think people are sometimes just focused on what is the easiest thing for them. They're focused on keeping the status quo. What they're not listening to is the illness on the East Side. Many leaders have come out, government officials have come out in support of this. Those government officials are not talking about the illnesses, the asthma, the respiratory illnesses, the cardiovascular illnesses. I'm pretty confident that if they would focus on that, they would listen a lot more to what has happened. And a lot of people are not listening because it's not their community. They don't care about the green space, the parks that were taken away. I hate to say they're not listening. I think it's better to say that they haven't been fully informed about what the situation is with the illnesses, with the 4.5 years of construction in that neighborhood, because those people wouldn't want it in their neighborhood. And yet this is going to happen. So I don't say they're not listening. I think what is happening is they don't have the information.
And just to be clear, this is open to the public, this hearing. It's at 25 Delaware Avenue, Part 27, and there's going to be plenty of room for everybody this afternoon, right?
That's in front of Judge Koliakovo, who has moved the hearing room to a larger area because of the many people and the press that are going to show up. So, yes, okay. There is room, 25 Delaware Avenue, Part 27.
Alan Bozier, thanks very much for your time this morning.
Baseball supernovas collide in the World Series. The Sabres look to win 3 straight. Canisius Hockey welcomes a top-ranked opponent. And 2 of Western New York's top basketball programs meet for a preseason tune-up. I'm Jack Cruiser. This is The Scoreboard for Friday, October 25th. You won't need a telescope to see the biggest stars in the game of baseball as the New York Yankees and Los Angeles Dodgers meet in the 2024 World Series. 2 seasons ago, Aaron Judge set the American League home run record with 62, but the Yankee captain hasn't been the best player for New York this postseason. Giancarlo Stanton was named MVP of the American League Championship Series with his powerful and consistent offense. Juan Soto was the most clutch of any Yankee, delivering the game-winning home run in extra innings of Game 5 to send New York to the World Series. Offense aside, the Yankees are led by ace pitcher Garrett Cole on the mound, who grew up going to Yankee Stadium, dreaming of wearing the pinstripes with a championship on the line. Across the country, the Dodgers' list of future Hall of Famers begins with world-renowned superstar Shohei Ohtani. Considered by many to be the greatest baseball player since Babe Ruth, Ohtani became the first player in the history of Major League Baseball to record 50 home runs and 50 stolen bases in one season this year. The once dual-threat pitcher has been used purely as a designated hitter in his first season with the Dodgers. Aside from Ohtani, they have shortstop Mookie Betts, who was named MVP of the American League back in 2018, a season he went on to win the World Series with the Boston Red Sox. Tommy Edman was the Dodgers MVP of the NLCS after being acquired at the trade deadline this season. The most well-known players meeting in a World Series between New York and LA is nothing new. They've met 11 times in the Fall Classic before, with the Yankees winning 8 of their 27 rings against the Dodgers. In their first World Series clash, Joe DiMaggio and Phil Rizzuto lined up for the Yankees against Pee Wee Reese and Billy Herman of the then Brooklyn Dodgers in 1941. In the mid to late 1950s, New York's Mickey Mantle and Yogi Berra took on the Dodgers' Jackie Robinson. Their last meeting in the 1981 World Series featured Ron the Penguin Say and Pedro Guerrero of the LA Dodgers, who beat New York's Reggie Jackson 4-2. The 2024 World Series begins tonight in Los Angeles. Games 1 and 2 will be at Dodger Stadium tonight and tomorrow. First pitch of both games is at 8 p.m. Last season, the Buffalo Sabres took till late February to win 3 consecutive games. Tomorrow, they'll have the chance to win 3 in a row, and it's just the 9th game of the new season. Buffalo hosts Detroit tomorrow afternoon. Currently, these two have the longest active playoff droughts in the NHL. The Sabres are going on year 14, and the Red Wings going on year 9. Despite that, the Red Wings have been a team directly competing with Buffalo for a postseason spot down the stretch the last couple years. 2 seasons ago, the Sabres were 1 point out of the playoffs, and last year, Detroit missed out on a tiebreaker for the final postseason spot. Safe to say, this is a mighty good chance for Buffalo to get back to a .500 record, gain ground on an opponent that may come in handy in April, and see the process pay off even more. Puck drop for the first black and red throwback game at KeyBank Center this season is slated for 1 p.m. on Saturday. It's not often that a top 10 nationally ranked college team in any sport comes to Buffalo, but this weekend the Canisius Golden Griffins hockey team hosts number 8 ranked Michigan State. If that's not reason enough to check out the game, the top defensive pairing for Michigan State is composed of 2 Sabres draftees, both sophomores for the Spartans, Maxim Strabek and Patrick Geary. The Griffs and Spartans face off twice this weekend in downtown Buffalo, tonight and Saturday, both 7 p.m. puck drops at the Lecom Harbor Center. The UB Bulls women's basketball team welcomes the Damon Wildcats to Alumni Arena this weekend for a tune-up ahead of the new season. After falling in the Mid-American Conference Championship game last year, the Bulls bring back 2 players named to the All-MAC preseason first team. The Damon Wildcats are a powerhouse in the East Coast Conference, winning 3 straight titles. The Wildcats graduated 4 of their top scorers last year, leaning on some younger talent to take the reins. Tip-off for the exhibition match is set for Sunday at 2 p.m. at Alumni Arena. This has been The Scoreboard for Friday, October 25th. I'm Jack Cruiser for WBFO Sports.
For Theater Talk on WBFO, I'm Anthony Chase.
And I'm Peter Hall.
And, well, I was out of town again, but before I went, I did get to see a couple of shows.
So where'd you go? What'd you see? Who'd you meet?
Well, who I met was interesting. I was at a kind of a convention. And among the interesting people I met was Barbara Luna, who is the last surviving member of the original cast of South Pacific on Broadway, where she played one of the 2 children of Emile Debec. And she sang Dites-moi to me, which I thought was very charming. She's 84 now. Do you remember from Dites-moi pourquoi la vie est belle? Just very, very dear, and reminisced about what it was like to do that show. Eventually, she did West Side Story, playing Anita 5 times. But I think that people in the audience remember her for appearing on Star Trek.
Now, when you say she sang to you, you mean you were in the audience and she appeared to be singing just to you?
No. I met her face to face.
She really did sing that to you?
She really did sing that personally to me. I met a few of the great Rodgers and Hammerstein stars. Thrilling to meet John Raitt.
Really?
Yeah, the original Billy Bigelow. And when I met him, he joked about being best remembered as the father of Bonnie Raitt at this point.
Oh, right.
Because he was a superstar, star of Carousel. He'd also done Oklahoma and a number of them. But he commented even then that he was among the last of the original Rodgers and Hammerstein stars.
Now, these are all actors from the golden days pre-microphone. They could fill a hall with their own voices.
Oh, John Reid, absolutely he could, yeah.
What a voice.
What a voice. What a gorgeous, voice. Gorgeous voice. If you doubt that, just listen to his soliloquy and Carousel on the recording. Impressive.
Which brings us to Hamilton, where I had a few problems with the audio. There were some of the actors I had trouble with their lyrics, and this is my third Hamilton, so I know the words, but I just couldn't make them out all the time.
I don't know what's going on with that. It was a little muddy, even from Roger, but I'd had a similar experience with Some Like It Hot. Even knowing the lyrics, and the faster it goes, the more upbeat it goes. So certain characters absolutely at a disadvantage. Jefferson, for example, at a disadvantage. But the precision of hip-hop lyrics, you want a revolution, I want a revelation. And when you're finding that indistinct, there seems to be an issue. But I did think that it has held its quality. I was especially moved this time round by A.D. Weaver as George Washington. Maybe it's just our actual historic moment. But the last goodbye, leaving the presidency, the peaceful transfer of power, but also pleading with posterity to remember him for the good things he made possible in the future, not for the many, many mistakes he made in his life, and remembering that later in his career, Washington had said that the one unavoidable regret of his life had been his owning of slaves. A marvelous reminder that we don't get to choose the historic moment into which we're born, and we make mistakes, and then the world continues. But I found that to be very moving, and I found A.D. Weaver's performance of George Washington to be thrilling.
He's a big man with a big voice. So
he's a big man with a big voice,
you'd yeah. have to be out in the lobby buying popcorn if you missed his performance. And tiny nitpicks aside, it's still Hamilton. It's still wonderful.
Absolutely.
On a much smaller scale, we went to the Allendale, where the Theater of Youth is in residence. But this time, it's being rented out to Bellissima Productions for a show I was not familiar with, but fell in love with the melodies, Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, I'd seen the original Broadway production, which had luscious voices. Jeremy Jordan as Clyde and Laura Osnes as Bonnie. I find the score thrilling. Seductive, even.
Yes.
I know this is not critically the preferred viewpoint. We are supposed to hate Mr. Wildhorn. Overblown. So is Andrew Lloyd Webber. We're supposed to dislike him, too.
And kudos to Bellissima for hiring a conductor. So we didn't have just someone leading from the keyboard, but we had an entire 7-person orchestra at the top of their game.
Aaron Shapiro, music direction for this, with 7 musicians, augmenting the voices very, very well.
And I was so disappointed, but I have a second chance. Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore had to take a little break this last weekend for COVID, but they'll be back at the Amherst Community Church this coming weekend.
HMS Pinafore. When I was a kid, many companies did Gilbert and Sullivan. Since I've been in Buffalo, these 40 years, it comes down to opera lights. They carry the torch. They keep it going. This has got everything you would want from Gilbert and Sullivan, including Baby Switched at Birth.
Of course.
the pressing issue of Social Class. Especially in my heart, my parents met during a production of HMS Pinafore.
So without Gilbert and Sullivan, you would not be here.
I would not be here. Thank you, Gilbert and Sullivan. For Theater Talk on WBFO,
I'm Peter Hall.
And I'm Anthony Chase.
Don't forget to like or subscribe so you can help others find this podcast. And if you love it, leave a review too. The WBFO Brief Podcast and the award-winning journalism of WBFO's news team are made possible by our members. Thank you for listening.